Hey idiots, I'm Jessica Michelle Singleton. I'm a stand-up comedian, and I'm also an idiot sometimes. Aren't we all? If you love to laugh as much as you love to learn about new people, I have a podcast for you called Hey Idiots. It's 50% hilarity, 50% curiosity, and 100% insanity. My guests include experts in their field, sometimes just other stand-up comedian friends, and occasionally absolutely insane people who have somehow convinced me they're knowledgeable about a topic. If you're into expanding your mind or just laughing out loud, check out the Hey Idiots podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Oh, she's trying.
I was yawning with my
mouth. Oh, okay, got it.
You thought I was burping?
I thought you were burping.
I thought you were shitting. I didn't know what was going on. Ian was like, she's doing it. And I was like, fuck.
This is Edging the Podcast, where we figure out what bodily function is happening in this moment.
I'll shit on mic for less money than I would need to shit on camera.
So. Yeah. No, yeah. That tracks. Yeah.
The absolutely. Audio of that feels fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Ian.
I'm Bridget.
They said, I mean, I'm Brooke.
How are we doing today? This is our third episode we've recorded today.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing them in a big batch here. How's everyone feeling?
It's a good spot. Yeah. I'm not hungry for pizza. I'm also not in my post-pizza coma.
Yeah, we've had some pizza. We've had some donuts.
Mm-hmm.
Had some Pepsi. Yeah, doing pretty good.
I'm in my post-episode recording to where I've just talked so much that my voice hurts.
Yeah, I feel ya. Oh.
But here we go again.
Here we are.
Let's do it.
Okay. I am bringing you all a confusing book. A book that's confusing a little bit at the beginning. Not so much confusing because they dropped the confusing bit like pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you all feel about writers writing themselves into their own stories?
Immediate hate. And to be clear, I'm fine with self-insert fanfic. I just don't think that we should call that a novel when it isn't.
Brave take. Hot take. Bridget?
I don't know if I've ever encountered that.
Oh, you're about to. I hope you're excited.
I'm a little scared, a little excited.
She's decidedly not excited. I think it's worthwhile. I, for our other podcast, kind of autobiographically write a lot, you know?
Well, yeah, that's a different thing, because I feel like any time that you are writing, a lot of the times it is based in some sort of truth.
Yeah.
But are you talking about, like, the author?
I'm talking about the author naming the narrator after themselves and talking in first person.
And also, is...
And it's fiction.
Is it fully fiction?
I think it's fully fiction.
Mostly, I think I was picturing someone self-inserting themselves into a nonfiction narrative as a storytelling device, which I did not like at all.
It's like I went back in time and I was at the JFK assassination or something.
Or like imagining themselves, yeah, in like some kind of historical something...
So do you remember when we went to Dallas and we were there for a convention and Shelby Novak was also there, a dear, dear friend of the pod, I guess this podcast too.
Yeah, all
Shelby's
of our
a friend
shows.
Of this show, yeah. But mostly 13. Shelby had been on the show several times. We're friends. And we went to the JFK assassination site.
That's sort of like a fun friend date.
Yeah, friend date, right? Mm-hmm. And we figured it out.
Yeah.
We figured it out.
And Brooke figured... I was not on this trip.
Shelby, too. Yeah.
Shelby,
yeah.
So the three of you all figured out what happened to JFK?
Yeah, we got it. We figured it out.
It's pretty easy once you're there.
And our patrons can learn the truth by joining up at at patreon.com/edgingthepodcast. Go there and we'll tell you exactly what happened to JFK.
Yeah.
Because we know it.
We do. And we also went to Whataburger afterwards.
We
hey,
did
what's
go.
That red dots on your all's forehead?
Oh, it's just bugs, you know.
Yeah, I don't think it's important.
It's a buggy apartment.
That just kind of shows up sometimes now. Anytime we talk about when we went to Dallas.
Actually, it does, doesn't it? That's why we don't talk about it that much. Also, just ate like way too much spicy food because it's so good. Yeah. Anyway, join the Patreon, learn what happened to JFK, and learn what happened to Richard Chismar in Chasing the Boogeyman. I have no idea how to segue out of that.
That was perfect.
Oh, man.
That was great. Seamless. Flawless.
I feel like I went into that bit so good, and then I just had no escape plan. So, Chasing the Boogeyman by Richard Chismar is my book this week. And I got to tell you, I've got complicated feelings about it. I don't love this book, but I also don't hate it. I think during the first episode that I did a book, I mentioned that I'm a really slow reader, which is why I exclusively do audiobooks, because I read so slow. And this book popped up in like the recommendations on Audible, and it seemed kind of interesting, but I don't know. I'll let you guys decide. I'm going to pull up the book cover, and I'm going to hand it to Brooke and tell us what you see.
So I'm seeing what looks to be like a stylistically edited photograph of a house. And it's really interesting because the perspective seems like it's across the street from the house, and it's like all of the lights are on, and then there's somehow more light coming out, which is a super interesting perspective and effect. And then in the center of the photograph is a tree sort of blocking the view of everything. And it's all like black and white, pretty spooky. And then the text is very forward and it's this orange color. And it just says Chasing the Boogeyman by Richard Chismar.
All right. I will give us a quick synopsis. Reaching for the phone.
Bridget, would you like to see the cover too?
Oh, yeah. We are that high tech here at Edging. All right. So,
from the cover, I don't think I'd read it.
Yeah. From the cover, I would read it if someone recommended it to me, I think. But the cover also makes me think that it's going to be about alien abduction.
Oh, I get that, actually. Yeah. I obviously saw the cover and wanted to read it because it was like an Audible recommendation. So there's that. Again, I'm not in love with this book. I did tell the audience that I'm a slow reader, so anything I read is going to become an episode of Edging, yes. Whether I like it or not, because I'm such a slow reader. But again, I don't hate it. I would read it. You know, it's a good way to pass the time. What are we rating the cover?
Let me look at it again.
Okay. I'm going to rate it like an 8 because, I don't know, I got my eye. I liked it.
I'm going to give it, because it's a house, as Brooke was describing, I'm going to give it 3, I almost said bay windows, but I don't think these are bay windows. I'm going to give it 3 windows out of 10 windows.
They can't see the windows. They could be bay windows.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give it 4 out of 10 bay windows, only because I'm pretty sure I know it's not about alien abduction, and so I feel lied to.
That's fair. In the summer of 1988, the mutilated bodies of several missing girls begin to turn up in a small Maryland town. The grisly evidence leads police to a terrifying assumption that a serial killer is on the loose in a quiet suburb. But soon the rumor begins to spread that the evil stalking local teens is not entirely human. So there we go. Synopsis. Okay. Another whole synopsis. That's where I'm going to stop reading though. So let's dive into Chasing the Boogeyman by Richard Chismar. So as I mentioned a little earlier, it's kind of weird because he literally drops himself in as the main character. And he does it in a way that like, I think that, so I've done this before when I'm writing something. I think I've got a really good, like, little gimmick or a really good little thing to do, and then it just doesn't work, but I've kind of entangled into the story too much that I can't fully remove it. I think that might be what happened here. So, Richard Chismar is the author of the book in real life. He's also the name of the narrator of this story who is writing this book. But again, it's completely fictional.
Is it written in third person?
No, it's written in first person.
That feels better.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's like through his eyes, right? But he's dropping his younger self basically into the story as the narrator. Did I get third and first person wrong?
First person is when you're like, I went to the store. Third person is would be like, Jimmy went to the store.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's first person.
Okay.
I was just thinking to myself, have we been doing submissions wrong for two or 3 years? Have we been telling people we want first person
for when 13 I don't know what the, yeah. our fiction podcast?
Yes, thank you. So this caused a lot of confusion for me in the beginning of the book because I didn't know whose perspective I was reading from at first, because it starts with a foreword that I'm not entirely sure is real. But like the person who writes it is real, and he talks about some real things that happen. Let me just kind of talk about what that is. In the foreword, we begin with a person who is talking about coming of age in Cleveland, Ohio, during the period of time when Ariel Castro kidnapped those girls and like kept him in a basement for like several years. Do you remember that? One of them escaped and they found the others, or maybe multiple girls escaped.
One girl escaped and she like got a man to help her out. And yeah. And they got all the other girls out.
Yeah. So this piece of shit, Ariel Castro, kidnapped these girls, held them for years in his basement.
It's like the quintessential, most horrific story like that.
Yeah. And they, I think they were kidnapped like quite some time apart. Like one girl had been there maybe a decade.
Yeah.
Insane. So the writer of the foreword was like a rookie journalist in Cleveland at the time that this happened. And I think this is a real person who's really writing it. I don't know for sure, though. He describes taking his family on vacation to a beach town in Maryland, where he finds on the like shelf of their like Airbnb rental a copy of Chasing the Boogeyman by Richard Chismar, which, by the way, has not been written yet because this is the foreword to that book. So he's talking about the fictional book, Chasing the Boogeyman, not the real one we're talking about. I know. This is where it kind of falls apart. So the author of the foreword becomes like obsessed with this book, can't put it down, finishes it in one day. And when he gets home, he looks at the murders from the book that he read about to see if they ever caught the guy, and finds out that they didn't. So he's treating this fictional book like it's a real true crime book. I guess it's like part of the world building. I'm not sure what he's trying to do here. It doesn't exactly work, but based on what's going to happen later in the book, I'm pretty sure that this is just a gimmick that got out of control. And then he just couldn't pull it back because it was too intertwined. I get it. It happens. It's happened to me. Never quite to this level, but it's happened to me. I get it. So anyway, we have this confusing start to the book, but luckily we're actually never really going to address this again until the absolute end of the book.
Yeah.
But the author of the foreword is not Nick.
The
author?
Who's the author?
The David. Author is literally Richard Chismar.
Richard Chismar. I don't know why I called him Nick. So the author of the David. Foreword is not Richard?
Correct. The author of the foreword is another person who is pretending to have found Richard's book.
And we don't know if this person is real.
We think he is, but we don't know for sure.
Alrighty.
Yeah. I didn't like the book enough to research it and find out. So again, luckily, this isn't going to be much of a problem because it kind of just evaporates.
Yeah.
And then they rehash it at the very end, I think, mostly just because they had to tie it up somehow. It's not going to be important. So we can kind of forget that confusing beginning to the book. And we're going to zoom in to the perspective of fictional Richard Chismar.
The camera actually zoomed in and out. When you
did it really? Is it because I did that weird motion?
Probably.
Does it? Oh man, that's cool.
It was funny.
That is funny. I'm sorry I missed that. We're going to zoom in on his perspective, and that's where we're going to stay. So let's get started. Our fictional Richard has graduated journalism school, and soon after, he kind of decides to go a different route. So he wants to be a journalist. As soon as he graduates, he's like, ah, fuck it, I don't want to be a journalist anymore. Instead, he moves back to his parents' house, back home to a town called Edgewood, Maryland, and he starts to pursue writing genre fiction. And this is the 1980s. So we're talking mysteries, thrillers, horror stories. He's trying to make a name for himself by selling them to magazines, which is like what you did back then. Instead of what you do now to get famous by like submitting your story to our horror podcast 13, which is the best way to do it. It's the best way to get known as a writer. But unfortunately, Richard didn't have that option.
So true.
He had to do the old-fashioned route, selling them to magazines and stuff like that. This is where our story really begins and where we're going to live in this story now and ignore the whole fourth wall breaking stuff that was going on before. But this story is going to be about a series of murders that occurred in 1988, just as he moves back home. And the author is going to take us on a trip down memory lane about this town with stories about what it was like growing up there. There's a lot of like typical little kid mischief. He's talking about his first crush. It's an older girl that lived next door named Melody. There's like a local haunted house, which is actually pretty fun. The urban legend around it's pretty cool. I like it. I'm not going to go into a lot of it here, but it's fun to read. All of this is like described as a very carefree, innocent childhood. And he goes on to tell us this whole backstory is meant to illustrate everything that they lost when the boogeyman came to town, which is a pretty cool setup.
Yeah.
I do like that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the first girl. We're just going to jump straight in. The first girl is named Natasha. She's quite a bit younger than our main character. He remembers her from before he went to college because he went to the same church as their family. So she was like in elementary school. They didn't interact very much because he's like in high school. She's in elementary school. There's not going to be a lot of interaction there in general. Mm-hmm. He moves away for college. He graduates. When he comes back, she's in high school. And Natasha went to bed one night. And when she didn't come down at her normal time in the morning, her mom went up to check on her. Her bed is empty. The window is open, which isn't unusual for this time of the year, but the window screen is missing. Her mom calls the police and they search and they find Natasha in the woods behind her house. I'm not going to talk about what happened to her here because I want you to read the book, but I will say we begin to see something that'll become like a signature for this killer. And I don't think I'm giving anything away when I say that it's like, we're in a fake true crime serial killer story. So after Natasha's found, something that happens in small towns in real life is going to happen in this town too. And that's going to be the rumors starting up. Mm-hmm. All the regular ones that you would expect. There's a funeral. At the funeral, our narrator like reconnects with Natasha's brother, who was closer to his age and he knew better when he was growing up. It's a tragedy, but this town is so far reacting to a single murder. Everything changes when another girl goes missing. Mm-hmm. Now we're not just talking about a single outlier murder. Now there's a predator on the loose.
Yeah.
The second girl is about the same age as Natasha. She walks to a friend's house for a sleepover. She lives in the same neighborhood, not very far away, but somewhere between her house and her friend, she goes missing. Now there's a panic setting in. One set of parents calls the other asking if she's still coming. The first set of parents are horrified to find out that she hasn't arrived there yet. Again, it's the 80s. No one's like texting back and forth. Mm-hmm. Another search begins and she's found later that same night on a local baseball field. Her murder was really similar, but somewhat different from Natasha's in one big way. And I'm not going to talk about what that one big way is. But it's kind of like the killer is evolving. Every murder that comes after this is going to be the same as the second one, but will be different from Natasha's, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Sorry, if you're not a patron and you want to know what that is, you'll have to read the book. It will come up in the ending, but we're not there yet. So this town really starts to like lose their shit and everything's really heating up now. What happened to the first girl again? It was a tragedy. It was a mystery. But now there's a predator out there and he's still out there and more rumors are getting started. There's about to be a lot of sightings. So people are going to be reporting every little strange thing they see. A little girl nearby walked into her parents' bedroom one night and said the boogeyman was trying to get into her window. She and her parents like believed that someone was walking around the house, looking in windows, trying to get in. Police can't find anything about it. They suggest that it might have been a bad dream, which is what they tend to do for some reason. The kids, you know, kids pick up like what their parents are talking about and then they have a bad dream, something like that. That's what they try and like pass it off as. This marks a turning point for our town. And it's just like one single illustration of it. Different scenes like this are playing out every single day, every single night, all over this little town.
Side note, if I were in this town, I unfortunately have to admit about myself. I am a certified yapper my entire life. I would be one of the people. I wouldn't be one of the people calling the cops like, oh, I saw something. Mm-hmm. But I would definitely be one of the people who was like, hey, Josie, did you hear?
I'd also be one of the people seeing shit at night.
I was going to say, the thing about this story is that it's so relatable because it happens all the time, because that's how most people react to this sort of thing. When you're afraid of something, you don't normally just sit back and internalize it quietly, right? Maybe you don't talk about it to a ton of people. Some people will, but you're going to talk to a few people about it, right?
Me. I'm the one who will talk to it about a bunch of people.
Bridget will talk to you about this kind of stuff. Give her a shout.
That way she can tell me.
Call me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to know what's going on.
I'm not a mystery at all.
So everyone is on edge. The playgrounds are mostly empty, and it's the 1980s. If there's anything we know about the 1980s, the playgrounds are fucking packed, whether they should be or not. Kids aren't playing outside by themselves without an adult. There's this eeriness and heaviness hanging over the town. Interestingly, what happens next? Brooke, do you want to guess what happens next?
Another girl dies?
No. Bridget, what do you think?
I think I know.
It's an ad break.
I was like not ready. I was like, oh my God, what happens next? Felt like getting called on in class.
Okay, we're back. And we left off after the murder of a second teenage girl in a town that's on edge. The state of high tension is where this town is going to stay for a little while. Our killer is going to lay low for a bit, but like other times where a community is under a lot of stress, it doesn't really feel like there's a break in the activity, right? Even though, like, there's not a new murder, everyone sees things, they're suspecting people, there's a lot of talk going on, and the stress is still very, very real. There are rumors circulating every time a kid isn't home on time, anytime someone hears something strange outside at night, you're seeing new people in town you don't recognize. At this point, we meet a new character, and we're going to zoom back in on Richard Chismar, and specifically his friend named Carly, who works at the local newspaper. Richard Chismar, he doesn't do Carly any favors here. He doesn't write her very well, I'll say. Carly exists to push this story forward in a few ways. She has no internal life, unfortunately. Carly's about his age. They knew each other in high school. She knows some things that the police are holding back from the public. She comes across them in the course of her investigation, and she's been asked not to report on them by the police. And for whatever reason, she decides to just like say fuck it, risk her career, and like possibly tip off a murderer by telling her friend Richard about them. Which my understanding, Bridget, having worked in local media, is actually pretty common, right?
Incredibly common.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's podcasts out there written about true crimes that I feel like I actually have found the answer to just from people yapping in newsrooms, but that we can't officially say. So it's very...
Also, Bridget, as a certified yapper that used to work in the news.
Oh, yeah. I've definitely told everybody every secret that I've known from the news stations.
Nobody needs to be having any secrets. Listen, we're just trying to tell the truth out here.
What is a journalist but someone who tells things that they've heard, right?
We're basically just literally certified yappers, but like... We're literally, most of it's reporting on gossip, because it's all secondhand. Even if it's, some of it's third hand. It's the police tell the news that this, that they were told that this happened. So it's, there's a lot of, it's like an onion.
It's like
it's
an
so
onion.
So like an onion.
All right. Some of those things that Carly tells Richard about, in both cases... both victims, something was left behind at the crime scene. Not an actual object, but like something else. I'm not going to talk about what that something else is because I want to save some mystery for people who want to read the book. And it is pretty interesting. I'm gonna shit on this book a little bit, but it kept my attention and I enjoyed it while I was reading it. Something else, it's not that like, I don't know, it's something that could fall under the radar. In one case, it's like a little hopscotch grid, and in the other, it's like a poster on a telephone pole, and there's something about those objects that is going to, like, stand out.
There's a hopscotch on the cover.
There is a hopscotch on the cover. That's right. They're not menacing. There's nothing like that, but they're just out of place. No one can like, account for how they got there. There's no kids that play hopscotch, like, around those houses, stuff like that, you know? The poster is for like a missing dog, but no dog exists like that in the neighborhood.
Alien abduction sounding a lot better now.
Right? Yeah.
I don't know.
Carly tells Richard that there's no evidence left behind at the crime scenes. This is a cool line. There's no fingerprints, nothing the police can use. The author writes, it's like someone sliced open a hole in the night, climbed out, and then climbed back in. That's a pretty fucking rad line.
Yeah.
Did our girl Carly say that?
Well, ultimately, the author, Richard, said that either way. But yes, Carly says that. So one thing that the girls had in common when they found them, they were smiling big post-mortem smiles that the killer had like engineered after they were killed, which I hate. That sucks. That sucks so much. So... something we haven't talked about much yet is that our narrator is a writer and he writes scary stories, right? He came back to town. He's living with his parents. He's trying to make a name for himself by writing scary stories, thrillers, murder mysteries. And he's submitting these out to magazines and he's trying to, you know, make something happen. But he's doing it at the same time that a serial killer is on the loose in his town, starting up about the time that he comes home. So understandably, that's not a good look.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good look at all. Only a handful of people know that he's doing that. Carly's one of them. His parents know. One of his neighbors also knows. But he's kind of trying to keep that a little closer to the chest for self-preservation reasons. But Carly decides for some reason that she wants everyone to know. Because that's what Carly does. Carly wants everyone to know.
Yeah.
It's been a while since the last murder. The paper needs some new material, so she proposes this human interest feature. And she spends quite a bit of time trying to convince him to let her write a feature about him submitting his stories and what it's like trying to make it as a writer. He thinks about it, and he tentatively agrees. Now, this is a process. Bridget, again, I'm looking at your background in media. A human interest story that I would imagine is about 6-7 paragraphs. Is that something worth spending dozens and dozens of hours trying to pursue, like for a media person?
I don't even know if it would be dozens and dozens of minutes, honestly. Stuff moves so fast in media that it's very rare that the most important story you're going to hear in your lifetime, that it had been worked on for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that, like, so a writer who hasn't actually published anything would, like, meet those standards?
No.
I don't think so either, no. Right? But Carly thinks that this is the way to go, right?
I'll say, though, small town media.
We're all familiar with these kinds of stories, right? We all came from small towns, right? And there's, like, the, you know, small town boy, small town girl, small town person leaves and, like, does a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And there's, like, the feature about him in the story. My problem here is that he hasn't fucking done anything yet, right?
That is true.
There's nothing to be done.
I mean, Carly's got to have a crush on him.
Carly absolutely has a crush on him. And
of course she does, because it's written by...
Yeah, of course, you know. And it's... Oh, okay. So this book is worth reading just to see this relationship from this author's perspective. Ugh. And I've got to say there. Mm. All right. One of those people that know what Richard's up to is his neighbor, right? I mentioned that he's an older guy. One day, while they're both outside, he calls him over and tells him a story. The neighbor starts talking about something that happened back in the 60s here in the town of Edgewood. For reference, this book is set in the 80s. I think it's 88. So to translate it to today, this would be like something that happened in like 2004, right?
Mm-hmm. Hey, can you shut the fuck up mm-hmm. with that?
Believe me, every time I see like this album is turning 20 years old, I want to fucking die. y'all have that to look forward to.
Oh, it's happening. It makes me want to fucking die, and I was just 10 when those albums came out.
Yeah.
It was summertime in this story, and we're talking about a little boy that went missing about 20 years prior. This little boy was playing in a creek with his friends. His friends, like, go off and do something, and he stays behind. When they come back to get him, all they found was one of his shoes left behind on the creek bank. Later the same summer, a little girl goes missing. She was playing in her front yard while her mom sat on the porch. The phone rang inside. She goes in for just a second to pick it up. When she comes back out, her daughter is gone, and neither of them are ever seen again.
Brooke and I keep, like, shaking our heads during this, but it's just, like, even though it's a fictional story, like, to just think of it in the context of, like, you just run in for a second.
Yeah.
Oh, man. As a parent, it fucking scares me to death.
Imagining, too, like, we can be a little roasty about the author for the way the mechanics of this worked out, but, like, I can see how he would have gotten in the weeds, because it does feel very realistic, mm-hmm. this kind of crime spree. Gotten in the weeds, kind of like trying to present it that way.
Yeah.
Because it feels like you're talking about a true crime situation.
Mm-hmm. So this town, we learn, kind of has a history of this sort of thing, right? And now we're wondering if these two strings of disappearances could somehow be connected. So naturally, as soon as he finishes his conversation with his neighbor, he goes inside and he calls Carly. And he tells her about the disappearances from 20 years ago. And Carly goes to work looking into them. And the next day, the two of them are sitting at his kitchen table looking over all this information that Carly dug up from the 1960s cases. They aren't, like, very similar to the 1980s cases. The kids in the 60s were a lot younger. Both the victims in the 80s are girls. In the 60s, it was a boy and a girl. And there didn't seem to be, like, much of anything else connecting them. Our narrator is disappointed, having thought that he'd, like, blown this whole case open, and now, you know, it doesn't seem like it was much of anything. But Carly isn't done. She produces this article from 1972, and this time it was about a teenage girl who'd been murdered. The cause of death was really similar to the 1980s cases, and the killer was never caught. So maybe the killer was growing up along with his victims, right? So when he's younger, he's killing people that are closer to his age, and he kind of stunts out there in the teenage years. That's the new working theory.
Hmm.
So The next bit of news comes when Carly calls our narrator. This is either later the same day or maybe the next day. I'm not sure. And she tells him that there's a landscaper that's been picked up and brought to the police station. This guy worked in the backyard of the first victim, and he worked two houses down from the house where the second victim lived. So it's looking a little bit questionable. So he tells him that he's in there for questioning, or sorry, Carly tells him that this guy is in there for questioning right now. Bridget, this is a pattern that we've run into over a couple of books that I've done. It's hard to put journalists into your story and make them interesting while accurately portraying the job, right?
Yeah.
Because ultimately, all jobs are pretty boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But journalism is one that we like want to be flashy. Is it normal for like a journalist to just call their friends and talk about leads and talk about like people in custody right now being questioned and shit like that?
Honestly, yes.
Yeah.
That does happen sometimes, of you'll get somebody being like, hey, this just happened, but it's not something that you can usually go with at the time.
Yeah.
So it's not something you can report on, but you, there's a lot of times when people get like a little heads up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really like put it against him here, because you have to make it interesting somehow.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's like when we did Night Film and they like meet up at the shady bus stop and like ride together and trade the records. Like, that's not how shit happens.
No.
Mm-hmm. But you have to make it interesting, and I don't hold that against the author. But the biggest problem with this tip is that Carly is wrong. So he gets off the phone with her, and it rings again almost immediately. He picks it up thinking that it's her, you know, having forgotten to say something or whatever. But this time, it's a man's voice, and he's acting strange. And he says something really cryptic. I'm not going to tell you what it is because it gives away some story. And then he hangs up. And this is going to be the beginning of some menacing phone calls that start coming in from who we assume to be the killer. And it can't be our landscaper, because our landscaper is in custody right now.
Oh.
And this person calling is clearly not. So after this, we get some more character development. We get some more urban legends, which I actually genuinely love. He does a great job with the world building for this town and the urban legends in it. That haunted house comes back up and there's like more stories. It's pretty cool. But at the end of the summer, a third girl goes missing. So we're about to talk about her, but first, it's another ad break.
Woo!
Ugh.
I know it can be a little confusing when to put those markers in, so I'm just going to help you out real quick.
Oh, no. No, I do appreciate that.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
You wait until I put a fucking like guitar lick behind that, and we've just made it into a fucking Tom Waits song.
The way that Mason will give us like a nice Midwest emo intro, we can talk it up with some poetry. I can't wait.
Nice. All right. We are back from our ad break, and we left off with a third victim. The third victim is named Madeline Wilcox. Maddie for short. We're going to call her Maddie.
Mads.
Maddie is different from the other girls in that she kind of has a reputation as a troublemaker, but not like real mischief, just like teenage stuff. Mm-hmm. But this is the 1980s. Maddie's mom went to her room to wake her up in the morning, and she found that she wasn't there. Her bed hadn't been slept in. Her mom starts to panic. She runs to the front window, and she sees Maddie's car in the driveway, and this is fucking devastating. She's like relieved for a moment, right? Because Maddie's home somewhere. Their car's here. Then she sees that Maddie hasn't left her keys in the normal spot by the door. She takes a closer look out the window, and she notices that the driver's side door of Maddie's car is just slightly ajar, and it's been like that all night. Just like the others, Maddie is found dead, beaten, and strangled a couple days later. This supercharges this nasty mood in the town, and even nastier rumors start to spread.
The rumors are worse because of Maddie's reputation, and a lot of people blame her for what happened to her. Of course, since this is the 1980s, it all gets wrapped up. Maddie's case and the others, and one of my favorite topics,
Satanic
panic, baby. Ah, I'm trying to be the kind of guy that can get away with like saying baby, you know, at things.
Yeah.
How did I do there?
That was pretty good.
Did that work?
Yeah.
I wasn't uncomfortable at all.
I can't tell if you're
serious. No, being genuine.
Yeah, I thought that one was good.
Was it good?
Yeah.
Can we use this podcast as a sort of like way for me to work on that and develop it? Like every now and then, can I drop a baby when it feels right and you guys can like rate it for me?
Yeah, I think the audience can vote.
Okay. Oh, that's scary.
Write in and hurt Ian's feelings if you don't like the baby.
Fucking tear me apart.
Don't put energy into that.
I was going to say no.
But we can put up polls on our Patreon that everyone can see.
Oh, yeah. And there we
can
go.
You can also join us on Patreon as a free member, and we'll let you see some stuff.
All right. So even Carly, right, this whole satanic panic stuff is going on. They're like talking about, you know, Maddie being into some things, you know, whatever. I don't know. Even Carly starts feeling this pressure, and she's usually like rational, calm, and disciplined. But one night when she's working on the story at home, she thinks that she hears somebody by her window. She thinks that she sees like a dark figure outside, but she can't be sure. And all around town, she feels like she's being followed. It's just one example of what everyone in this town is going through all the time. One thing that changes after Maddie's murder is that the town puts a whole town-wide curfew into place. Restaurants, shops, bars, everything closes early, and at night the streets are dead silent. Now, we're about halfway through the book here, and at this point, we've got some urban legends, we got some murders, we've got some rising tensions in a small town, and this is the point where our whole story is going to like take a little bit of a turn. We've got a high school girl named Annie who's walking home from school when the boogeyman tries to take her but fails. So she's walking home and a masked man comes at her. Unlike before, the police are able to like keep a lid on this like attempted abduction. So far, like Carly knows fucking everything, right? Mm-hmm. She's talking to Richard and who the fuck knows who else. They manage to like get everybody involved in this to keep their mouth shut, and they fucking manage to keep their mouth shut too. So you remember how this is kind of like a weird memoir, true crime story that's like written from his perspective and all this stuff. We're going to go into that like true crime element for a minute. And when I say true crime, I mean fictional, but you know, Carly in our story gets a copy of Annie's statement to the police, but no one is good at their job, of course. And Carly, our reporter, is going to just fucking give this thing to Richard, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, she likes him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is like later on after it's all over with. So this isn't happening in real time. But like later on, she gives Richard a copy of this statement. So I'm going to summarize it here now. Annie was walking home as the town was going inside for curfew. There were cars on their way home, but no one was like out walking. Anyone that's out is heading home for the night. She starts to hear footsteps behind her, and she looks behind her, but she doesn't see anything. A few minutes later, she hears it again, and this time when she turns around, he is right over her shoulder. He's wearing a mask that looks like a cloth sack with eye holes cut into it. I imagine like the kind of mask from that movie, The Town That Dreaded Sundown, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He grabbed her by the neck, hard enough to like lift her up off the ground. And he's trying to pull her back into some trees, but she fights like hell and she screams as loud as she can. And when all this started happening, she starts carrying pepper spray with her after the other girls are missing. And she was able to reach it and she just like starts fucking spraying like wildly behind her. And the pepper spray gets into the eye holes of his mask and like fills it up, right?
Oh, I love that.
This causes him to rip the mask off. He's like got tears running down his face and he's rubbing his eyes. And this means that she got eyes on him.
Mm-hmm.
So she's able to give a description to the police. But this comes with its own problems because Now the police have a description of a pretty generic sounding white dude in a pretty generic white suburb, and he looks like fucking everybody you know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Even more rumors start to spread around town. I'm going to skip over a lot of stuff here, and a few more weeks pass, and it's Halloween night. The town has settled back a little bit since Maddie's murder. These things like ebb and flow, right? The tension spikes, and people can only stay on edge for so long, so it starts to taper. It's tapered a little bit by Halloween. Our narrator, Richard, is hosting a Halloween party, and while they're handing out candy to trick-or-treaters, he's giving the last group of the night their candy, and across the street, he notices somebody. He thinks maybe it's a dad waiting for their kids to wrap it up. He can't tell. But it looks like he might be wearing a mask, that same kind of mask like Annie described in her story, that town that dreaded sundown kind of mask. Later that night, we learn about the fourth victim. She was on her way home from a Halloween party. Her name is Cassidy Birch. Her mom was waiting up reading a book, and she started getting nervous when her daughter was late. Then she heard a car pull up and a door open. There's music playing a little bit too loud. She can hear it a little better when the door opens. You know, that kind of sound, right? She's relieved that her daughter's home, but a couple minutes pass, and she doesn't come inside. Her mom steps out the door to check, and she is nowhere to be found. She calls her daughter's friend, the one where she'd been hanging out, and wants to just confirm that she was the one who stopped in front of the house and, like, had the music playing, dropped her off. And she said that she was. Cassidy got out of her car at her house, but somewhere between the curb and the door, she went missing, which sounds a lot like what happened to Maddie.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got, like, an MO starting here. A few hours later, her body's found in some woods near her neighborhood. She's been staged in this, like, ring of jack-o'-lanterns, which adds even more anxiety than the previous murders, because now if you have a jack-o'-lantern missing off your porch, you can be pretty sure, or at least pretty scared, that the boogeyman came and took that from your porch. It could have been a kid, but you don't know.
It could have been the boogeyman.
It could have been the boogeyman. And it was for at least a few people. So some more time passes, and this cycle of outrage, paranoia, rumor, all this stuff, it takes its course. Things calm back down, and our narrator is getting some stories published. He's making a name for himself. Some people are buying his things. And one day, Carly comes around with some photos from the newspaper. The newspaper, and, you know, again, who the fuck is this guy? Why is she, like, coming to him for help, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, the newspaper's photographer realized that they had taken photos at all the different memorials that had been set up for the summer, like for these girls. And when he checked back, he found that each of those, like, memorials, there were photos where things had been left that matched up to the crime scenes or other crime scenes, things that only the killer could have known. So the killer had been at all these memorials, and he'd been leaving things behind. So they realized that if they've got photos of all these memorials, they got photos of the crowds too. And they can look and see if there are the same people at each of these different memorials. Maybe they can even look and see if they can figure out who it is that's leaving these little clues behind. Something else happens. The neighborhood watch is still going on. It started up after the first murder. And you've got all these suburban dads with guns, roaming the streets at night after curfew, scared to death. And how do you think that's going to end, Brooke?
I know, I feel safer.
You feel a lot
safer?
Knowing
that all of these very anxious men are ready to protect house and home.
Yeah.
I think someone's going to get hurt.
You would think right. Just one night after Thanksgiving, one of the neighborhood watchmen sneaks up on another neighborhood watchman. And they spook each other, and one of them gets shot, thinking it was the murderer, but it wasn't. Just one more reason that neighborhood watches are a great idea. We should all do them, right?
Yeah.
This definitely doesn't happen more often than not. Finally, and sadly, before we move into the Patreon-only version, one more thing happens in our story. The first victim, Natasha Gallagher, she's the one that kicked this whole thing off. Her father gets up one night, careful not to wake his wife. He gets a flashlight and a gun, and he slinks out the back door. He closes it as quietly as he can behind him, and he walks out into the woods behind the house where the spot where his daughter's body was found. He drops the flashlight on the ground, and he puts the gun in his mouth. Time continues to move on, and there's no new prank phone calls, no new unsettling feelings, no feeling like you're being watched. Things are going back to normal. And now, remember in the beginning of the book how I said it's weird? We've got this guy who's dropped himself in as the fictional narrator. Now our fictional writer is going to begin writing the book that we've all just read, right? So we've seen this trope before, right? And we can see how he got there. We can see a world where it could have worked, but he just started it out so weird, you know?
It just doesn't work.
Tried to do so much with it, right?
I've been there, though.
Yeah.
Right? No, we all have, right? Yeah. That brings us right... At the end of the fucking day, this dude read a book. Like, how many of us, like, fucking do that, right? You know, can only shit talk so much.
And also, like... It's a good book with good writing that you like. So, like, even though there are things that don't work, the writing being good is why you read it.
Yeah, it is. And it got me to the end. And that's I don't finish books I don't like. So, yeah. That brings us right up to where we learn who the boogeyman is. Are you all ready to learn who the boogeyman is?
I am ready.
You're ready? All right. If you are ready to know who the boogeyman is, you can hear the full episode on Patreon. patreon.com/edgingthepodcast Bridget Brooke, here we go.
When she was. Damn.
Right.
It's a funeral.
So that's not actually an alibi. Whoa.
Now, why?
I don't know if I would read this book, but I would watch a miniseries on it.
I would agree.
I'd definitely listen to like a 6-part podcast about this book.
Yeah, I would. I like the concept of the story. I think I would like to see it workshopped by someone else at a different stage. And then like getting to see it go to production on something would be good. It feels a little bit messy.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I think so, too. Ultimately, I read it. I read it through. I liked it enough to finish it. I wouldn't say I regret reading it.
No.
It's not my favorite book, but I don't hate it. You know, I like it. I like it enough. If you want to find out whether you like this book, you can find it on Audible, where I listen to it, or wherever else you get your books. It's Chasing the Boogeyman by Richard Chismar. And we love you.
We love you.
Mwah.